with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we go. It is the 18th day of August 2015. Yes, the 18th day of the month in which we celebrate the birth of the first Roman emperor over 2,000 years ago. The birth month for young Octavian was in the... This was the sixth month, I believe, Sextilis, and it was named in honor of Octavian after he became the beloved emperor and institutor and creator of the Pax Romana. We remember his adoptive uncle in July, Julius Caesar. We remember his adopted nephew, adopted posthumously in August, as Augustus was the reverential appellation that was given to him. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And, Randy telling me, I'm not sure, but I don't think Rick Smith has relinquished the stream. Let's get that dealt with right quick. Oh, okay. Yeah, never mind. Andy just said loud and clear on my Mac. So, wonderful. That's great news. So, anyway, happy 18th day of August. I'm not sure exactly what day, and I don't know that anybody is particularly sure what day Augustus was born on, but this is the month when we remember him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was the sixth month, because September, that's the Latin word for seventh. And consequently, that would mean that this is the sixth. So, the new year started with the month of March, named for Mars, because in March, the legions could begin to gather, and it was not just planting season, but war season. I mention that for a reason, and thank you, Jeremy in Vermont, noting loud and clear on TuneIn. I mention that for a reason, because we are, of course, at present, beset by a gang of warmongers in this country. We are beset by people who do not want peace with Iran, but instead want to send people you love, most likely, young men, young women, off to do war with Iran. I don't know why. Well, maybe I do. Cherchez l'argent, cui bono, right? I'm sure there are a lot of people who oppose the deal with the agreement, the multinational agreement with Iran. I'm sure there are a lot of people who would who have stock portfolios, which will do quite well if we can only gin up another blood-sodden disaster in the Near East. And again, my apologies. My apologies for any artifactual, irritating noises. We got wires that have to be replaced. And, well, Radio Shack went kaput, so that means they're going to have. It's a weekend job. You'll just have to deal with it until I can get it fixed. Sorry. So, I thought it might be interesting when the opportunity arose, and you know that we do not have a lot of guests on this program, but the opportunity arose, and, well, we're going to have an honest-to-goodness, no kidding, rocket scientist on the program, a nuclear physicist, as a matter of fact, who supports the agreement with Iran. The former New Jersey member of the United States House of Representatives, Rush Holt, will join us here in a few minutes. And we'll talk about the Iran agreement, because he's in support of it, along with something on the order of 29 other extremely intelligent scientists, nuclear scientists, physicists, yes. And maybe we can figure out why these people, and we've got a new one to add to the list. New Jersey's Senator Robert Menendez has declared that he will not support the Iran agreement. He is siding with the senator from Israel, Charles Schumer, New York, in opposing this agreement. And I'm having a hard time trying to figure out how one opposes this in good faith. So maybe I'll get to ask some questions that I've wanted to ask for a very long time of former Congressman Dr. Holt. I'm looking forward to it. Oh, by the way, before we do get started, a brief announcement. We try to raise $200 every evening to keep the program going. We're at zero for the evening. The PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com. And, of course, the mailing address is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. So, yes, here in a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by Rush Holt. For those of you who don't know who he is, Rush Holt was for 16 years a member of the House of Representatives from New Jersey. He is a highly educated man with a brilliant mind, among other things. Just one second. Sorry about that. Had to make sure that lovely Agnes was back here to take Dr. Holt's call. And she is. But at any rate, Rush Holt left the Congress with this Congress that is in session now. He was the representative from the New Jersey 12th Congressional District, 1999 to 2015. He's only the second research physicist to be elected to the Congress. He's the first research physicist who was elected as a Democrat. Having left the Congress, he's now the CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and is the executive publisher of the Science-branded family of journals. He has been, among other things in his life, a faculty member at Swarthmore College. Taught physics, public policy, and religion courses. He's been a Congressional Science Fellow for U.S. Representative Bob Edgar in Pennsylvania. He's been the head of the Nuclear and Scientific Division of the Office of Strategic Forces at the U.S. Department of State, assistant director of the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory at Princeton University. That, by the way, is the university's largest research facility. It's also the largest center for energy research in New Jersey. Among other things, he has stood up for issues relating to science and to health, to the environment, to attempt to cap greenhouse gas emissions. He's promoted the development and use of alternative energy sources. And from a from an Appalachian perspective, Dr. Holt is a proud son of West Virginia. And he comes from a pretty exalted line. His grandfather supported Eugene V. Debs in his presidential bid. His father was the youngest member of the Senate. In fact, he was elected when he was 29, but couldn't take office until he was 30. So Rush Holt, in addition to being an honest-to-goodness, no kidding, rocket scientist, has deep, deep Appalachian West Virginia roots. And among other things, was among the first members, the first people in the House of Representatives to actually talk about on the floor of the House the what we know now as the public health crisis that is afflicting mountaintop removal communities here as we experience vastly elevated rates of cancer, heart disease, genitourinary diseases, birth defects, depression. And then Congressman Rush Holt was, I believe, if not the first, the nearly the first, to mention that brutal reality. It is a pleasure and an honor, then, to welcome Dr. Rush Holt to the horn. Are you there, Dr. Holt? One second. Wrong button. Sorry about that. There you are, Dr. Holt. Thank you for your thank you for calling in this evening and joining us in this conversation.
Yes, hello, Bob. It's good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
It is a real joy and a real pleasure for a variety of reasons. Obviously, we're talking this evening specifically surrounding the nuclear arms agreement with Iran and the opposition that some are manifesting toward it. But of course, as I've noted for the members of the Horn Family Commune congregation here, there's a broader universe of things as well that touch your scientific background. But let us start and stay pretty much with the Iran issue, Dr. Holt. You're in support of it, correct?
I am. I think it is a big step for nuclear nonproliferation. It is a good deal. It's the most stringent that has ever been negotiated, and I think it sets back Iran from any possible bomb building. It sets them back dramatically, and that was the point of this. It wasn't to make all right with the world. It wasn't to change everything about Iran. It was to remove the possibility of nuclear terrorism.
And in point of fact, there's a history in this country of certain political elements in this country opposing anything in the way of trying to forestall a nuclear disaster. Because when Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan first began talking about some stand downs from the brink of nuclear annihilation, there was extreme right wing opposition to that too, wasn't there?
Sure. I mean, that's, you know, what a lot of people forget is these agreements are never discussed with people who are your friends. These are agreements that you arrive at with people that you don't quite trust. So everybody says, oh, well, wouldn't it be nice if, wouldn't it be nice if? In this case, we're dealing with an agreement that is not based on trust, but is based on verification. And with the suspicion that there might be cheating. So we ask ourselves, will they always and for all time behave well? That would be nice, and maybe they will, but that's not what this agreement is about.
Well, I've seen ads on the television by a group that's opposed to this agreement, Dr. Holt, in which they say things like, we wanted a better agreement. What would be a better agreement than what the Iranians have agreed to? And by that I mean, is it a better agreement if you've got a list of wishes and the Iranians say no thank you and walk away from the table?
Well, you know, there are examples in modern history of countries that were on the path to building a bomb, or in fact did build a bomb, and then decided they would forswear that. South Africa, some South American countries were very far along toward building a bomb. South Africa had the bomb. And they, Sweden at one time, and they publicly forsook that. They said they will not have a bomb, and they opened their place up for everyone to see, and the world was satisfied that they had given it up. Maybe Iran will do that. Let's hope so. This agreement, however, is set up in such a way that Iran has very severe restrictions on what it can do, and the world has great access to verifying that Iran is abiding by those restrictions. So, you know, the only thing better than this would be for Iran to open the country up in such a way that, like, you know, Brazil or Argentina or South Africa, the world to be sure that there is and never will be any nuclear weapon construction. But, you know, you can't bomb a country into the Stone Age and expect it to lose the knowledge. So I suppose there are some people here that's just what they're itching for. They think the only solution is military. Well, in fact, you can't stop a nation from having the knowledge of how to build a bomb militarily.
You because the very nature of humanity is such that that knowledge disperses.
That's right. Besides, I think any rational person would say a war with Iran is going to be bad for everyone concerned. And so this is a good agreement because it means you don't have to go to war, and you can have assurance that Iran is not building a bomb without having to go to war, and besides, going to war wouldn't have given you that assurance anyway.
Well, exactly. And this is not a position that you are taking standing out there all by yourself. You are affiliated in this with a group of other scientists, physicists, research experts. Why or how did you reach the conclusion that you have that this agreement is right for the United States?
Well, you know, there are a number of people who have said this is a good agreement. There are political scientists and international types. You know, there's a letter from distinguished ambassadors and international relations people. There's a letter from to the president from retired flag officers, generals and admirals who say this is a good agreement. I wrote along with 28 other scientists, and most of them very distinguished, a letter to the president saying, we've looked at this from a technical point of view because we understand the physics and engineering of weapons and weapons proliferation. And this is an agreement that hangs together technically. It's an innovative agreement, and it limits the paths, the foreseeable paths that Iran could take if they wanted to build a bomb. And it lays out procedures for verifying that those paths are indeed blocked.
Let me ask this in regard to the agreement. I understand that there is an element to this, Dr. Holt, that arises simply because there's a contingent inside the Congress that says that if Barack Obama wants to rescue kittens from burning trees, they're going to bring flamethrowers. That has to be taken into account. But just a short time ago, news broke that from your in New Jersey, Senator Robert Menendez of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has announced that he will oppose the agreement. Is there once we sort of filter out the opposition for opposition's sake element, is there a good faith argument against this agreement?
Well, I don't know. Did you say that it was news that Bob Menendez opposes it? I could have predicted that a year ago before there was even an agreement. I'm not surprised that Bob has opposed this, but many others support it. Some of the people who oppose it, as you point out, as soon as President Obama said he had an agreement, they said, well, then we're against it. There are a variety of people who take their hatred or distrust of Iran to such lengths that they won't ever have an agreement with them, even if not having an agreement would make things worse, would make things riskier, which is indeed the case. It would make it riskier if we didn't have this agreement.
Can we say fairly, Dr. Holt, that not having this agreement will make war more likely in the near term?
I guess yes. If I suppose that's another way of saying what I would say is this makes war less likely and unnecessary for nuclear reasons. Now, other people might decide they want to go to war with Iran because of their support for Hezbollah or because of human rights violations or something of the sort. But this removes any need to go to war to stop them from building a bomb. And if Iran flagrantly violates this agreement, it will be known quickly, and all options, as the president has said, would still be available to those people who want all those options. So this only means that for 10 years, or actually more like 25 years, the risk is greatly reduced, and at any time along the way, 25 years from now or sooner, if the agreement is abrogated, no options are lost.
Well, let's talk a minute, because I asked that question, Dr. Holt, because Senator Menendez said at Seton Hall University in a speech, if Iran is to acquire a nuclear bomb, it will not have my name on it. I don't think if Iran gets a bomb that Dr. Rush Holt or the other 28 scientists are there. I don't think their names are going to be on it. But it disturbs me as the father of a generation that a member of the generation that would fight a war with Iran. It disturbs me that with what Senator Menendez is saying is if we go to war with Iran, it will have his name on it. And with that under consideration, let's talk about the risk that you just mentioned. We don't want nations to enter the nuclear club, if you will, and we would prefer that nations that are in it now weren't. But the fact that the geographic fact of the matter is that Iran sits in a part of the world where you have an at best marginally stable Pakistani government, which has the bomb and despises Iran. You have India, which is no great friend of Iran, and they have the bomb. You have the Saudi Arabians, the Saudi Arabians, who have us for a friend, and, well, you know, we've got it. And then there is that great unmentionable, and for the life of me, I don't understand why, and I've been waiting for an opportunity to ask someone in the know this question so that I can maybe get some clarity out of it. If we were to even assume that Iran were to acquire a nuclear weapon, on the day that Iran has won, Israel has 200 pointed at them. Are we assuming, Dr. Holt, that the Iranians are just crazy people who, if they had a nuclear device, would use it against a whole bunch of different countries that have a whole lot more than them?
Well, I think a rational person would say it is not in Iran's interest to get a nuclear weapon. It would not strengthen them politically. It would not strengthen them economically. It would not strengthen them diplomatically. And actually, as most military people will tell you, it wouldn't even strengthen them militarily. We've used a couple of nuclear bombs, and most military people think that was a mistake. Most military people, at least after they retire, generals and admirals, will say nuclear weapons are not militarily useful. But I don't mean to argue that right now. That's a kind of a longer and different argument.
Yes.
What I do want to argue right now is that Iran's path to a bomb, whether it's through uranium enrichment or plutonium production and reprocessing, whether it's through centrifuge enrichment of uranium or some other kind, laser or other kind of enrichment, they won't be able to do that. This is an innovative agreement in several ways. One is that it doesn't just look at the number of centrifuges that would be used for enrichment. It looks at this the two factors, the quantity of uranium that they would have available to them and the techniques for enriching that uranium to make it of a bomb-grade uranium. And that is restricted. The reactor that would produce plutonium, that could produce plutonium, will not be completed. It will be redesigned and reconstructed in a way that would not give it large amounts of plutonium. All of the existing known sites are subject to constant surveillance and immediate inspection. And if Iran tries to have a covert site, that too would be detected quickly, and inspections would be available in short order, not immediate, because no sovereign country is going to let other countries come in and go anyplace on demand. We don't allow that for other countries who want to inspect our military sites, and it's not surprising that Iran wouldn't accept that either. But this agreement has the unprecedented requirement that any suspected hidden sites can also be visited, not instantly, but in enough time to deter any weapons program. So, you know, it's innovative, it's strong, and it is based on verification. So that makes it good. I would further add that a lot of these parts of this agreement should be made part of the general IAEA non-proliferation arrangements that apply to all countries. In other words, this is more stringent than is normally applied to a country to detect and deter weapons construction. And so I hope that these strong provisions will be made globally applicable. And there's a chance to do that, and we should take that chance. This, you know, the good features of this bill, of this agreement, should be extended.
What about Iran's claim that they seek nuclear technology for purposes of power production? Of course, they're a huge oil producer.
That's what they say. Yeah, that's what they say. I mean, even Saudi Arabia is thinking about building nuclear reactors. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Nuclear reactors are, I guess I would say, nothing but trouble.
Fukushima, you know, comes to mind.
They don't produce electricity that's too cheap to meter, despite what the early proponents used to say. They're not trouble-free, as we've seen in Fukushima and Three Mile Island and any number of other places. They have a legacy that lasts not just a generation, but many, many centuries. And so, you know, it's not a good way to go, and Iran should know better. If they want to show their technical and scientific prowess, there are a lot of other ways to do it. And, in fact, that's another good feature of this agreement. International scientific cooperation is part of the agreement. The Fordo uranium enrichment facility will be shut down, and it will be converted to other scientific purposes, some of it having to do with medical isotopes and that sort of thing, but also other things that are completely unrelated to nuclear power. And this international nuclear power or nuclear weapons, and this international scientific cooperation, I think, will yield benefits. There's some who say, oh, you don't want to cooperate with your enemy by sending scientists over there. Well, look at the Soviet Union. I mean, you know, we never had a bigger enemy than the Soviet Union. And yet scientific exchanges ultimately led to the fall of the Soviet Union and the softening, you know, the glasnost and perestroika that resulted in the fall of the Soviet Union. So the scientific exchanges that are built into this agreement will probably, I think, pay dividends, political dividends, and probably will help advance what we're trying to advance here.
Well, there are social dividends as well, are there not, Doctor? Because
that's what I mean. Yeah.
One of the earliest of which we know in the archaeological record, one of the earliest wind turbines ever built on Earth was invented by the Persians. And the last I checked, the sun shines all over that part of the world, and the wind blows there. And you're also very much concerned as a scientist with the climate impending climate catastrophe, with the need to reduce CO2 emissions. Is there a way, do you think, and I'm gauging this by your previous answer, is there a way that, you know, that even perhaps indirectly, that this agreement could be an opening door for nudging that portion of the world in that direction? I mean, I think the answer is yes.
That's an important part of this agreement, but I do want to emphasize the central part of this agreement is restrictions on nuclear technology, nuclear materials, and the verification to ensure that those restrictions work. But combined with that are these provisions for scientific cooperation that, as I say, will probably yield dividends. We saw it with the Soviet Union, where the exchange of scientists actually helped politically. Now, some people will say, oh, this is a soft argument. If you don't like that argument, just look at the restrictions on the nuclear technology and the verifications in this agreement. But I also like to look at what is, I think, an attractive potential in this agreement that will lead to international scientific cooperation that will soften the hardliners and advance our interests.
15 years buys the world some time too, because frankly, even supreme ayatollahs are mortal men, and attitudes are changing in Iran. And Iran is not the only country with hardliners in it. I suppose another question would be, given your status as a scientist, and given your intimate knowledge of just how much rejection of science occurs inside this country, is that another part of it? Is the lack of essential scientific literacy in this country part of the means by which the other side can leverage fears and bigotries among the citizenry?
Well, I think our understanding and appreciation of science in the United States is not getting stronger. It's actually getting weaker. I hate to see us go that direction. It's bad for us economically, but you're right. It's also bad for us in international relations. I think people are saying really irrational things about this agreement, against the agreement, because they don't understand it, and they think that it's beyond their comprehension. It shouldn't be beyond comprehension of a well-informed citizen who is comfortable thinking about science. And, you know, there are a couple of points that I do want to make. People say, well, 10 years from now or 15 years from now, Iran would still be able to build a bomb. Well, you know, before this agreement, they were within weeks of having enough enriched uranium to build a bomb. They could have done it a year ago. They could have done it this year. They didn't do it for some reason. And it wasn't because of the sanctions. Maybe it was because they feared an attack. Maybe it was because there really is a fatwa from the a declaration from the Ayatollah that they will not tolerate, they will not build, they will not hold weapons of mass destruction. It's possible. Whatever it is, they didn't build a weapon when they could have. This puts it back at least 10 years. And so some people say, well, 10 years from now, they could build a bomb. Well, you know, without this agreement, as Secretary Kerry put it, 10 years would be tomorrow. They could build a bomb right now if they didn't have that agreement.
Within
weeks.
And 10 years and from now, so, they could be a democracy, too, couldn't they?
Right. Well, and a lot of people say, well, we're reducing the sanctions on them, and that will give them billions of dollars to cause mischief. Yes, but the sanctions wouldn't stop any country from building a bomb. If, you know, a country of tens of millions of people has the wherewithal to build a bomb, even if there are severe sanctions. Severe sanctions didn't stop them from causing mischief with Hezbollah, which is, you know, a deadly action. So removing sanctions won't change those things. They by themselves won't make Iran more peaceable, improve human rights, improve international relations, but they will make it possible. They will make it possible. And the sanctions won't make nuclear, removing the sanctions won't make building nuclear weapons any more likely, because it wasn't the sanctions that held them back.
Sanctions certainly.
It was other factors.
Yeah, sanctions certainly worked so well for the last 55 years in Cuba, now, didn't they?
Right. Yeah. Well, sanctions did get Iran to the table. I'm pretty sure that was a principal motivation in getting them to talk about this agreement. So in that sense, the sanctions were effective. They didn't stop support for terrorism from Iran. They didn't stop Iran from building a nuclear weapon if they wanted to.
So I guess, and then the big question also, and having sat in the House for as long as you did, you know the ramifications. Is there any way to put the mind of the Israelis at ease? Because that seems to be an undercurrent to all of this.
Well, actually, you know, one thing that's been lost in the news here is there are a number of military officers, retired military officers in Israel. Obviously, active duty people can't say anything. Actually, they can't state policy at all. But retired military, there are a number of retired military officers, and actually the a former head of Israeli intelligence. They've said this is a good agreement that makes Israel safer. So it's not everybody in Israel thinks that this is a bad deal. Evidently, Prime Minister Netanyahu does, but he thought it was a bad deal before there was a deal. I'm not sure that there's any satisfying him. A number of people in Israel are satisfied that this is a good deal for Israel. I mean, they weren't part of the negotiators, but that it results in a benefit to them, in a safer Middle East. It reduces, almost removes the possibility of nuclear terrorism.
And yet it's interesting. I don't turn on Morning Joe or any of the morning news programs and hear anybody talking about these, about the fact that these loyal Israelis are out there saying, yes, this would be good for Israel. It certainly seems to me that there are strings being pulled somewhere that want this agreement to collapse. I hope that it doesn't. What within the framework of how Congress works, can this agreement go forward without the Senate or without the House?
Well, this is it's put forward in a sort of a backward way, a reverse way, which may actually end up helping the president. The vote will be whether or not to disapprove of the agreement rather than to approve the agreement. So I think we can expect a majority, because the Republicans are in the majority, we can expect a majority to vote against the agreement. The president would then veto that legislation, that he would veto that disapproval, and for them to stop the agreement, they would have to have a supermajority to override the president's rejection. And so that's not likely to happen. It's fairly close. It does sound convoluted, I know, but it may help the president, even though there's a majority in Congress that is, well, pretty much set against anything the president wants to do.
Indeed. And the reason I mention that is I think back to and I've mentioned it on this broadcast, I think back, Dr. Holt, to a time when the Senate of the United States put its foot down and absolutely refused to have anything to do with the League of Nations. And that bore some rather horrible fruit in less than a generation. And I don't want to see that happen again. And I know you don't either. And I'm quite gun shy of people standing in front of cameras and saying, yes, but what about the yellow cake from Niger that Curveball told us about in Prague? I saw that movie, Doctor, and I don't have any interest in staying for the repeat. What can people do out here? Because we seem to be pretty well divorced from the workings of our own government, I'm afraid. What can people do to actually feel like they're advancing the idea, the cause of peace? Because this agreement is in the name of peace. What can people do to feel like that they're trying to preserve a peace instead of acceding to the wishes of, well, for lack of a better word, warmongers?
Well, I mean, what can people do? I think they should be advocating for international engagement rather than war. They should be advocating for strengthening the nuclear non-proliferation regime, which this does. Although my roots are in West Virginia and I love the state, I'm not completely up to date on where your congressional delegation is on this. I would guess that the Republican House members are opposing it. I hope they don't. I hope they will hear from West Virginians that an agreement that makes us safer and makes nuclear weapons less likely would be something that the West Virginia delegation would support. I'm not sure about the senators. I'm not quite sure where they are on this. I think I heard that Senator Capito was against the agreement, but I'm not sure. So, what should people do? I would say West Virginians should, by all means, let their legislators know how they feel.
And Senator Manchin, it was a surprise to me that Senator Manchin said he was going to give the agreement a fair shot, and that his initial inclination was to be supportive of it. That came as a real surprise to me.
I've worked with Joe and like him, and he's a thoughtful person. I hope he will give this thought.
Well, and one last question, Dr. Holt. Is there anything in the agreement that makes you that really does give you pause that you wish had been different, or is there a flaw in it that you wish had been done some other way?
Well, as I said at the beginning, it would be great if Iran joined this club of nations who have had nuclear weapons programs and publicly denounced them and removed them and opened up their society so that everybody could see they were gone, that the weapons programs were gone. Iran could do that. They haven't yet. It is true that Ayatollah said, I have made a declaration, we will not have nuclear bombs, we will not build them, we will not hold them. So there's some things he could do to open up the country to reassure us all that that's true. But he hasn't yet. So, it'd be nice if we didn't have to have such an agreement. But we do, because the Iran hasn't yet given us good confidence and trust.
And it was Reagan who said, trust but verify.
That's right. There are, this doesn't deal with ballistic missiles. That will have to be dealt with otherwise. But this was meant to be restrictions on nuclear technology and nuclear weapons programs, and it does that very well. As I said, it doesn't deal with all international complaints about human rights violations or support of terrorism. There are a lot of things that Iran has yet to do to be a fully respected member of international society. And you know, I hope Iran will do that soon. What this does is what it was set out, what was intended, which is provide good verification that the routes to the several paths that would be a possible route to nuclear weapons for Iran are blocked.
And for the sake of American children, Iranian children, and probably children all over the world, that's a good thing. Dr. Holt, it has been a pleasure having you on the program. Thank you for giving us a few extra minutes. And before we go, let me simply offer you my thanks, my unending thanks, for your support of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act when you were in the House. There is an unfolding public health crisis in this state where you were born, and it sent chills down my spine when you referenced it on the House, because it has been a dirty little secret in this country that needs to be much more light on it.
Yeah, I'm proud of my service in Congress. I feel good about my 16 years of service. In my last term, which ended just in January of this year, I announced that I would step aside. I don't regret doing that. It was time. There comes a time for any person, I think. But I do feel good about my service there. And protecting the environment and public health whenever I had the opportunity to do that is something that I'm particularly proud of. And I should mention, actually, since I'm talking to West Virginia here, I'm also really very proud of my mother.
Absolutely.
Her memorial service was just last week. She was the first woman in statewide office in West Virginia.
Yes.
And she was proud of that to the day she died, which was just a few weeks ago. And she was proud that WVU gave her an honorary degree a couple of years ago at age 99, so that was 3 years ago. I was pleased that she got two standing ovations from the graduates there at WVU when she gave her address when she received her honorary degree. And that made her so pleased that her adopted state would treat her so well. So I just had to get that in. I realize that's not the...
Oh, no. I'm more than tickled.
But,
I'm more than tickled for you to have done it, and I'm sorry to hear of the passing of your mother. I didn't realize that. She does hold a place of pride in this state, and especially for women in this state. That was a hyper testosterone era in which she served as the Secretary of State here, and your dad as well, and heck, your grandfather. I mean, it took some courage, even a man from Weston, West Virginia, a little place like Weston, to stand up in 1919 and say, "I support the presidential campaign of Eugene V. Debs." That's inspiring, frankly.
Well, my father was fearless politician, and his father, although he wasn't really a politician, he was mayor of Weston. He was the town doctor and editor of the newspaper. He was fearless too, and they each got in trouble sometimes because they said what they thought. I'm proud of them too.
Well, if the opportunity ever arises, Dr. Holt, for you to make it back down this way, and I don't know if you've ever seen the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone. But at a word from you, I'll make a couple of calls. We'll get you a flyover, and you can see what's being done down there. And just because you're not in the House anymore doesn't mean we don't still need your proud voice on the issue.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy whenever I'm back in the state, and I look forward to it. Yes, I have seen mountaintop removal. I probably haven't seen all the horrors of it. There's probably still more horrors for me to see. Look forward to coming back and hope to see you. And I'd be pleased to talk with you on air or otherwise anytime.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Holt. Thank you very, very kindly. I wish you a very good evening and a lovely remainder to the summer. And absolutely, our best wishes go with you as you try to appeal to the better angels of the nature of America in supporting this agreement and hopefully averting warfare. We thank you, and we wish you the very, very best, sir.
Thanks, Bob, and best to you.
Bye now. Nuclear physicist and former member of the House of Representatives from New Jersey, Dr. Rush Holt. And again, our thanks to him for taking time to have this conversation, not just with West Virginians, but with people all over the planet. We desperately need voices of good faith and goodwill in a world that is entirely, all too often, dominated by the voices of those who would send others to the wars for which they yearn. It is about 4 minutes before the hour, and here endeth the first hour of the program. We will take a little break and then come back to, news of the day. Your comments, your thoughts, your calls, your observations. Email comes in to bobkincaid@gmail.com. You can also reach me on Twitter @bobkincaid. You can reach me on Facebook, Bob Kincaid. A pattern emerges, and Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact on Skype. If you want to reach the program via Skype and you've never done it before, send me a contact request there. You can also dial 304-574-8178 or the stress line 304-663-4676, 304-663-HORN. Okay. So, there you have it. And also, this being Tuesday, and it is, we've got the Green News Report coming up with Brad Friedman, if this is going. With any luck at all, that'll be as good as it always is. So, yeah, a little break, and then back at it. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be right back.
It's Tuesday, August 18, 2015.
It is just looking for problems by going up there and drilling for oil.
Obama administration gives final approval for Shell's Arctic drilling adventure.
Hi, everybody. Later this month, I'm going to Alaska.
As Obama announces the first presidential visit to the Arctic. July 2015, the hottest July on record. A monster El Nino is brewing in the Pacific. Plus,
I'm suing the executive branch of the United States federal government.
Oregon children sue to force the government to act on climate change.
All of that acting and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The EPA, who was supposed to prevent this, spilled 3 million gallons of acid mine sludge into the river, turned the river yellow and toxic. It's a huge screw-up, but Donald Trump said it gave him a great idea how to keep Mexicans from crossing the Rio Grande.
So there's that. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I have been hearing the promise of a monster El Nino to hit California for about 2 or 3 years now, and still no rain, still dry as a bone out here. So pardon me if I'm skeptical about the latest claims of a Godzilla El Nino.
Yeah, a lot of people are, but we'll see what actually happens.
What do those scientists know anyway?
But more on that in a moment. First, oil giant Shell is now drilling for oil in the fragile Arctic. Despite major protests and blockades by kayaktivists in the Pacific Northwest to halt Shell's Arctic adventure, the Obama administration on Monday issued the final permits for Shell to drill 2 exploration wells before the end of September, now that required safety equipment has arrived on site. In an interview with local Anchorage News, Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society warned that Shell's record in the Arctic is abysmal.
Their record from 2012 drilling in the Arctic Ocean was a disaster by anyone's measure. One of their drill rigs grounded near Kodiak. There were fires. There were criminal penalties for air pollution violations.
The okay was given despite the fact that the U.S. Coast Guard has repeatedly warned that it does not have the budget or the equipment that it really needs to mount a full oil spill response in the Arctic Circle. Criticism was swift from Greenpeace and other big environmental organizations, which have all vowed to continue their efforts to stop drilling in the Arctic. The move to approve Arctic drilling comes just a few days after the Obama administration announced President Obama will be making a special trip to the Arctic Circle to call attention to the impacts of global warming, which are caused by the very same fossil fuels that Shell is drilling for. Obama did not mention fossil fuels or Arctic drilling in a White House video announcing his trip.
And I'm going because Alaskans are on the front lines of one of the greatest challenges we face this century, climate change. You see, climate change once seemed like a problem for future generations, but for most Americans, it's already a reality.
How does the Obama administration square this circle? I don't get it. Permit the opening of the Arctic to fossil fuel drilling and then go on up to the Arctic and say, hey, climate change is terrible. I don't get it. Has he been pressed by the mainstream corporate media on that apparent contradiction?
No, he has not been pressed on that by the corporate media, and there really isn't any explanation for this complete contradiction in policy.
I guess we can only hope that once he gets up to the Arctic, when is that?
August 31st.
Then hopefully the media will press him on that. I just don't get it.
In Oregon, a group of American children have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. federal government to demand action on climate change. The nonprofit group, Our Children's Trust, filed the lawsuit on behalf of 21 plaintiffs, ranging in age from 8 to 19. They're asking the District Court of Oregon to require a national plan to reduce the nation's carbon emissions that cause global warming. 18-year-old plaintiff Tia Hatton explains.
The purpose of the case is to protect our rights for life, liberty, and property. They depend upon a healthy climate. And right now that healthy climate is being negatively impacted by the government allowing and promoting the use of fossil fuel.
The complaint accuses Obama and the federal government of knowingly risking harm to human life, liberty, and property through intensive fossil fuel use.
Is there any chance that this suit will actually work, or is this largely just a show suit to demonstrate the problem?
It is part of a growing trend to use the legal system for action on climate change, but so far none of these lawsuits have been successful. successful in the United States. Finally, July 2015 was the hottest July ever recorded globally. That's according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. Just like June 2015 was the hottest June on record, and May 2015 was the hottest May on record, July is continuing the trend. And on top of that, scientists say a major El Nino event is gathering strength in the Pacific, making it all but certain that 2015 will crush the record for hottest year that was set just last year.
That's what the forecasters and people who know what they're talking about say, but Ted Cruz tells me the globe is cooling. I'm going with Ted. For much more on all of these stories, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Eight and a half minutes past the hour on this Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. And now where shall we? By the way, something that came up outside broadcast, but I think it's worth mentioning while I was talking to Dr. Holt, Ron up in Canada mentioned by way of a note, Bob, the UAE is building a 5,600 megawatt nuclear reactor even as we speak. If you're on the American friends list, you can do that. Well, if you're not, though, not so much. Yeah. Which, and this is amazing, because it's like there's a, some sort of ethereal thought link going on among the Rons. Ron and Raleigh sent an email, subject line, what I want to know. Hey, Bob. Hey, Ron. I want to know when any of these international agreements and inspection regimes will apply to the most dangerous country in the Middle East, which is Israel. Ask over 2,200 Palestinians in Gaza who's crazy. P.S. Maybe the Iranians didn't build a bomb because they said they wouldn't. Did you ever think of that? Yeah, I know. Funny how we could do the whole, well, Mommy, ketchup is a vegetable, trust but verify. We could do that after some initial pissing and moaning from the hardcore war-loving right wing. We could do that with the Soviets, but not with the Iranians, because they're crazy. And Dr. Holt's completely correct. Having a nuclear weapon does not make a country safer. But we have not yet succeeded in convincing people of that because, among other things, and I mean, history is history and facts are facts, we as the United States have a history of attacking countries that don't have nuclear weapons and not attacking the ones who do. Hello, North Korea! Yeah. I was reminded as Dr. Holt was talking of a quote from James Madison, which Dr. Bill has mentioned on a number of occasions lately. He's been doing a brilliant job analyzing almost line by line Federalist Number 10. It's worth your time. Of course, you can always sign up for the podcast via whiterosesociety.org. Any screw-ups in the podcast are my responsibility and my fault. But I think I've got it. But James Madison said, if men were angels, there would be no need of government. And that's true on so many levels. It's true in international diplomacy, foreign affairs, and it's true in domestic policy as well. And we've got several examples of that.
Did you notice that Jared, you haven't been seeing any more Jared Subway commercials? You remember Jared, right? Men were angels. Yeah, Jared of his own volition ate nothing but Subway sandwiches and lost a boatload of weight, and to the point that he was made the Subway spokesman until, you know, recently. He got dumped by Subway last month, Jared Fogle did. Because, see, law enforcement officials in Indiana raided his home. And they confiscated his computers. And now, announced, or it hit the... wires today, being reported by WXIN-TV, that Jared Fogle has reached an agreement with prosecutors by which he will plead guilty to possession of child pornography. Damn. I don't understand it. Not by a long shot. But apparently there's money in it, which is probably all the explanation you really need when it comes right down to it. Over at the Progressive Secular Humanist blog, Michael Stone is reporting that the now not nearly so wealthy as they used to be Duggar family, and it's a gift we didn't really want or need, who gave the word into the lexicon, the popular slang, Duggery. That's incestuous sexual abuse, which goes covered up for years, and when uncovered, is immediately defended by the religion industry. TLC. No learning in TLC. No TOS in Pravda, no Pravda in TOS. There's a special coming August the 30th. Why did I even give you the date? Called Breaking the Silence. TLC describing it as an attempt by the network to shed light on the issue of child sex abuse. It'll feature appearances by members of the Duggar clan. It will run commercial free. That's okay. They'll make them up in the other programs. A statement from TLC said, over these past weeks, TLC has consulted regularly with leading victims' rights and advocacy organizations in the U.S., including Rain and Darkness to Light, to discuss how to use this moment to address the issue and make a positive impact. Unfortunately, child sexual abuse is not an isolated issue. It affects many children and families around the world, including one down in Arkansas. But that's okay. The guy who rehomed the children to be re-abused is going to get a Family Courage Award sometime when Ted Cruz isn't sitting next to him. To that end, we are partnering with both organizations on a multi-platform campaign to raise awareness and educate parents and families about the issue. In the first phase of this initiative, TLC will work closely with both groups and with the Duggar family on a one-hour documentary that will include Jill and Jessa and other survivors and families that have been affected by abuse. Yeah. TLC started talking about it. The Duggars always grubbing and grabbling after money because Jesus said, can we be in your sex abuse show? Well, in the name of Jesus, we sure do want to. And so consequently, Michael Stone at Progressive Secular Humanist blog is reporting that the Duggars are trying to pitch a spinoff show in which they will counsel other Christian families who have victims of child sexual abuse in them. No, really. Now, this isn't a hockey puck moment. This is a get a bucket moment. Well, I mean, who could counsel better? I mean, look, we counsel our son so good that he don't sexual abuse no more, and we counsel so good that our daughters don't get sexual abuse no more. We's real good at the sexual abuse incest counseling. Really. The Duggars are hoping to launch a spinoff show relating to the upcoming documentary. You can almost every episode is going to be, well, and then Bubba Joe Bob, he reached under the dress of our 3-year-old, and Michelle can just break it. Now wait just a minute right there. We need a moment of prayer. And we need for you to forgive and forget. These people disgust me. Jim and Joe Bob. No, Michelle and Jim Bob. Oh, jeez. The Duggar parents are still convinced that their son was not a child sexual predator, but that they were being persecuted for being Christians. No, really. Might be a busy evening. I saw this story earlier today, and I couldn't help wondering how much Donald T. Rump has to do with it. Chelsea O'Donnell, 17 years old, the teenage daughter of Rosie O'Donnell, has disappeared. A release by Ms. O'Donnell said that her daughter Chelsea left home with her therapy dog and is in need of medical attention, that she had stopped taking her medication. Reckon, is there any cost associated with a billionaire sociopath plutocrat like Donald Trump constantly waging a war on one individual because he doesn't like the way she thinks or talks or looks? After T-Rump re-slimed Rosie O'Donnell in the GOP circus a couple of weeks ago, Rosie O'Donnell didn't respond with any sort of sharp-tongued or acid-witted remark. All she said in response to the slimy behavior of a slimy man was, "Try explaining that to your kids." Apparently, it's not easy. And my, and I'm sure our hopes and thoughts go out that Miss O'Donnell, Chelsea, 17 years old, will be found and brought safely home. She's been, well, police have been looking for her since day before yesterday. But, you know, in America, wealth conveys the right and privilege to say or do just about anything one wants. If you're rich enough, you can say anything and pretty well get away with it. Because money. Make no mistake, this is a hard country. It's a hard country for working people. It's a hard country for people who want to, never mind getting ahead. It's a hard country for people who want to survive. It's an especially hard country for women. If you don't have some billionaire publicly trying to shame you, and his supporters and Republicans generally in the audience just clapping and laughing, hey, Christian GOP, you reckon maybe all your clapping and laughing might have had anything to do with a 17-year-old girl's decision to walk away from home and not come back? Yeah. It was just last night that we were having a lovely conversation with the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansasstan. And lo and behold, Kansas News, only a day later. Yesterday, a man carrying knives and an improvised explosive device, an IED, into the clinic, the women's reproductive care clinic that had previously been operated by Dr. George Tiller, who, after night after night after night of Bill O'Reilly hooting, "Tiller the killer, Tiller the killer, Tiller the killer," was finally assassinated in church by an upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian. Yep, he had knives and a little bomb in a backpack when he tried to get into the Southwind Women's Health Center in Wichita. George Tiller was assassinated, but it was reopened. Julie Burkhart now runs the clinic, and they do not perform abortions there as far into the term as Dr. Tiller did. So that means there's one less alternative for women desperately in need of services. But even though she backed off how far into the term they would do an abortion, still, the God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered Christians weren't happy. One of them suggested it would be, and this is a quote, "a blessing to the babies." A blessing to the babies. If someone would assassinate Julie Burkhart the way that Dr. Tiller was murdered. Dave Leach is the Christian's name. in a recorded phone conversation posted on YouTube between Dave Leach and Scott Roeder. Roeder is the man who killed Dr. Killer in 2009. That's when they talked about the blessing baby. If someone would shoot the new abortionists like Scott shot George Tiller, hardly anyone will appreciate it but the babies. It will be a blessing to the babies. Everyone else will panic, of all places, to open up a killing office, to reopen the one office in the United States more notorious for decades than any other, is an act of defiance against God and the last remaining reverence for human life. No irony there. No reverence for human life for Dr. Tiller or Ms. Burkhart, whom they want to treat in similar fashion. The man is in custody. Yeah. I don't think, well, one wonders what sort of punishment he'll face. Interesting that the news report, and I'm going to read it to you verbatim, no funny voices, no accents, no nothing. Police, the interesting about this is what it doesn't say. Police say a man is in custody after he brought a small improvised explosive device into a women's health care clinic that provides abortions in South Central Kansas. Wichita Police Department spokesman Doug Nolte says officers responded to the Southwind Women's Center around 3:30 p.m. Monday. He says on-site security inspected a backpack the man brought in and found knives and the explosive device. Officials told CBS affiliate KWCH in Wichita that the suspect was also carrying a small box wrapped in tape. Clinic staff evacuated the building and a bomb squad was called to remove the backpack. No injuries were reported. Nolte says the police are investigating whether the man intended to harm the clinic. The FBI and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives are also investigating. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... There are just a small handful of basic questions that good journalism must answer in order to be good journalism. The first is who. You know, who, what, when, where, why, how much. One, two, three, four, five. Five paragraphs in. And there's still no mention of who done it. The clinic is one of three in Kansas that provide abortions and opened in 2013 in the same building where Dr. George Tiller provided abortions before he was gunned down in 2009. Gunned down. How about assassinated? Because it was. It was an assassination. Tiller's killer, Scott Roeder, said that he had chosen to obey God's law to save babies after shooting Tiller while the doctor was serving as an usher in church. In a statement, the clinic said today, our staff and local law enforcement handled a threat to the safety of our patients and staff promptly and effectively. The systems that we have in place to protect our patients and staff work. Well, that just means the white wingers and the God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christians will have to build a bigger bomb in the name of Jesus. But I just read you every word of that story. Who was it? Why did police not release his name? They've arrested him. He's in custody. That is a phrase I'm looking for. Public record. Nolte says police are investigating whether the man intended to harm the clinic. No, he intended to help the clinic. He was bringing him some knives and an IED. In case there was a particularly recalcitrant fetus that needed to be excised. Show of hands. Anybody want to bet? Because I'd put a $5 bill down that this guy is white. Mm-hmm. I'd put down a $20 bill that he's Christian. And I'd really like to know why this white Christian male domestic terrorist, alleged, gets a pass on having his name published in the paper. Now, I'll bet you, by God, if he got caught trying to pick up a hooker, they'd get it into the newspaper, just on the police blotter. But no, if you wander into an abortion facility, if you wander into a women's reproductive health care facility with knives and a pipe bomb, well, the for-profit media will protect your privacy. Son of a... Well, okay, so we know he's 20 years old, and he's a white man, and he's white, and no, he does not have a Muslim surname. But we don't know what his name is. Don't know why it is that we have to have all this carrying on in America. If only we could go back to the good old days. Right? The good old days when men were men and women were silent. Let's check in with the paranoia roundup, otherwise known as Outnumbered, over on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda, co-hosted by one of our Fox favorites, Andrea Tarantula. Remember, she's the one who said that Eric Holder runs the Department of Justice like the Black Panthers. You know Outnumbered. Four extremely attractive women in very short dresses sit and ask questions of a guy from, and there's always a long shot to show all of their legs. Because, oddly enough, on Fox, apparently women talk with their legs and not their mouths. Mm-hmm. The discussion this time through, why are Republican women, Republican couples, more likely to say they're happy with their marriage? Well, there could be no better person to answer that question than Rachel Campos Duffy, who is married to Wisconsin Republican House member Sean Duffy, who wanted to see a 22-mile-long, half-mile-wide, 1,400-foot-deep hole in the ground put where the Pinocchio Hills used to be. I mean, there's some family values, poisoning a whole lot of people's water for money. But, no, let's... Well, let her speak for herself, shall we?
Your happily ever after may come down to which way you lean politically. According to a new study, Republicans are far happier and more stable in their marriages than Democrats are. Among married couples, 67% of Republicans say that they are very happy in their marriages, while just 60% of Democrats say the same. And when it comes to divorce, Democrats are 6% more likely to split with their partner. One researcher says that Republicans seem more likely to embrace a, quote, marriage mindset. Okay, to the woman sitting on my right, who is on the right, who's been married for how many years?
Going on 17 years.
To a congressman with seven children.
Seven children.
Do you agree?
Wait, she's married to a congressman with seven children? Does the congressman's wife, does the mother of the seven children know? Oh, professional broadcast talent. You just can't touch this stuff. I mean, there's a reason they get paid what they do. Married to a congressman with seven children. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that it's automatically defined that Republican women stay in marriages, whereas Democratic and progressive and liberal women get the hell out when the marriage goes bad. I love it that the reason for that, as posited by Andrea Tarantula, is that women are more Republican women are more marriage minded. Then again, maybe they're afraid that they'll go to hell. You know, the hell that was created by their loving God because he loves them so much, because their Bible says that divorce is not permitted and you just have to stand there after he's hit you the 15th or 16th time and say, do it again, I can put a little stank on it. Jesus. But anyway, let's go back to Ms. Campos Duffy, who is married to a congressman with seven children.
With this study?
I do, and I really think it's not about politics. I think it's about religion. I think more Republicans tend to be religious people. And I know for myself, and I know in the Greek Orthodox Church, there's the same idea of sanctification, that marriage is a sacrament. It's a holy thing. And my job being married is to get my husband and my kids to heaven with me. And I think that that changes the whole perspective on marriage.
What do you...
And yet, if it was to be in the news tomorrow that Rachel Campos Duffy had murdered her husband and her seven children, we wouldn't think it was really part of her job to get them to heaven with her, would we? No. Of course, we also have to take into account the fact that 67% of Republican men who are very happy in their marriage are also on rent boy sites and are addicted to porn. Somehow or another, the studies always leave that part out. Oh, well. But anyway, Ms. Campos Duffy's going to take her children to heaven with her.
What do you think, Senator? I mean, there is a theory, according to this study, that more traditional values apply to the Republican Party, and these traditions are things that families sort of keep intact, that helps them keep intact.
This is Senator Fotogenic, probably from Utah or somewhere.
Been married 29 years, going on 2,900 sometimes, but it's still...
Oh, wait, he's not even a senator. No, that's not Senator Fotogenic from Utah. That's former Senator Scott Brown of staple in the belly button fame. You know, the centerfold, the Playgirl centerfold.
Aww. Still good. Very much in
Senator.
Love still and very, very happy. And I never thought of it as a Democrat or Republican thing. I just think, you know, you find somebody, you're happy
yeah.
with them, you love them, you treat them with dignity and respect, and you kind of stay together. And if it doesn't work out, then you find a way to amicably separate and treat the kids as the number one priority if you have kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of that is, you know, not being caught when you're cruising the Kmart parking lot in your Mercedes. Looking for little boys to tell about all about the saving grace of Jesus Christ, because that happened.
Still write songs for
I
your...
Did.
I mean, not to Scott Brown, but it happened. It was the vice president of the Oklahoma Southern Baptist Convention some 10 years back or so, if I recall correctly. I may have some of the details wrong, but Exalted Southern Baptist... department store parking lot, Mercedes Benz, rolls down window. Hey, buddy, can I? Hey, kid, you want to learn about Jesus? I've got a Snickers and a Coke. Yeah, that part's pretty much true.
I wrote her a song for our 29th wedding anniversary, so it worked out well.
Harris, I know miserable Republican marriages, and I know miserable Democratic marriages, so I don't know if I'm necessarily smelling what this study's cooking, maybe. What do you think?
Yeah, I didn't really give this a whole lot of thought in terms of the politics or the religion. I think it just has to do with reinforcement. So, I don't know. I think politically it seems strange to me, but if you're in a group of people that support you as a married couple, that
well, guess out. What? We're in a group right here that supports
we'll
each other.
All right, so we just wrapped up the TV version of us talking a little bit about who stays married longer, Democrats or Republicans. And you didn't get to chime in, so I
know, and I noticed when Andrea was going to you to answer a question, she goes, you go like, that's... Like to look at
yeah, because I thought for sure she was going to talk to you. So I'm curious to know what you think.
I don't put any weight into this study. I don't. I don't know.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, I've only been married for, I have to think. I've been married 5 years, so I'm not like a marriage expert by any stretch.
How long have you been married, Andrea Tarantula?
But I believe that some studies just show up. And you can make anything you want out of the numbers.
It's kind of silly. I agree with you.
But, I mean, I think there's something to saying that there are certain groups of people that hold marriage on a pedestal more so than others, and they do see it as a lifetime commitment rather than something that you do.
No. I was Sandra on this one. I mean, I think that you can see happy marriages on the right and on the left.
Gay, straight,
miserable
happy,
ones on the right
sad,
and the right.
White, yeah.
Although, I would say, and this isn't the case every time, but I go back to that Glamour magazine story that we did here on the couch where they...
Oh, dear. Hockey puck.
They put out a column with traditional advice that women should make their man a sandwich if he were hungry. And I said, why not? I support this. This isn't transporting women back to the 1950s. It's just kindness. And look, if I'm hungry, I would expect him to make me a sandwich, right? So,
oh, here we go.
Right? So then I get crucified by feminists. Mostly, we know, coming from liberal blogs. And I just thought, well, what's the alternative? I mean, ladies.
Really? She got crucified. Raise your hands if you're sure. Come on. Let's see the holes, Andrea Tarantula. Crucified. I tell you what, That's some God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christian devotion there, where getting criticized by somebody for something you said is the equivalent of having nails driven through, you know, railroad spikes, for God's sakes, practically. I mean, the big nail. We're not talking about roofing nails. Roofing nails would hurt. But great, big, tetanus-laden iron nails driven through... You're probably not your hands, but more likely between the two bones in your arm, and that's going to feel great. And then something, down around the feet, the legs, whatever. That's the same thing as being criticized for saying something stupid in order to keep getting your paycheck on Fox. Get him a damn sandwich. And you know what? Andrea Tarantula has an ally. She does.
And look, if I'm hungry, I would expect him to make me a sandwich, right? So,
oh, here we go.
Right? So then I get crucified by feminists. Mostly, we know, coming from liberal blogs. And I just thought, well, what's the alternative? I mean, ladies, if you want to fight with me all day and be against the side of kindness and respect for the one that you love, that's a fight I'll have all day long with
you. And it shows they're more likely to get divorced because they won't make that sandwich.
See, that's the divorce problem in America. This is what Emory and Marvelline tune in for every damn day. Simple answers to complex questions. We have divorce in the country because the liberal feminist women's won't go out there and make a sandwich for their hubbies. If they just make a sandwich now and then, he wouldn't have to slap her around so much. You know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see the political breakdown of domestic violence statistics in this country. Huh? Huh? How many good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, Christian, Republican women
stay in marriages when they're still getting the kicked out of them every day by their God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christian spouse. Yeah. By the way, thank you, Carol. News update, Chelsea O'Donnell has been found. She is safe. She is in police care in New Jersey with her dog. Good. Now, if only Andrea Tarantula and Rachel Campos Duffy could find her a man, maybe she could make him a sandwich and have a happy marriage. Oh, yeah. Follow-up to the Wichita story, Beth in Dallas. Wichita Clinic Damage Control, the Wichita PD, Beth reports, is now pushing the narrative that some poor homeless 19-year-old guy just happened to be carrying several knives and a big firework when he wandered in off the street looking for a job. Says Beth, sure, that's logical, because most young men who need work think of an abortion-providing clinic first, and a guy has a better chance of getting the job if he brings his own tools. Beth adds, in 22 years of working at a clinic, you can probably guess how many times we saw that happen. None, never, not, no. None. Because I'm sure he wasn't a God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered Christian who was out to save the fetuses, because the babies would be grateful if Julie Burkhart was murdered like Dr. Killer. Yeah, kind of just goes on. But hey, there's some good news. There's some good news for women out there today. The FDA has just approved a brand new drug that insurance providers can refuse to pay for women. I am a cynical one, aren't I? The name of the drug is, and I have no idea how to pronounce this, Addyi. A-D-D-Y-I. Can't wait for the ads. Addyi is produced by Sprout Pharmaceuticals in the Valley of the Jolly Green Giant. Little green sprout. And I'm not making light of the drug. I think it could be wonderful for people. It is the first drug ever approved for men or women, and for once we got it for the women first, that treats flagging or not even there libido. You know, Viagra is a boner pill. But it doesn't do anything about, you know, wanting to have sex. So this isn't a boner pill, but it'll apparently help women whose libidos are not what they're, what some guy thinks they should be. No, I'm being cynical again. Maybe you remember what your libido was and it's flagged over the years and you'd like to have some of that old spark back. Maybe a sprout. Try not to get smart aleck about this. Failing. And so you'll get a prescription for Addyi. Sally Greenberg, executive director of the National Consumers League, said this is the biggest breakthrough for women's sexual health since the pill. Oh, we get the pronouncer in paragraph 7. Thanks, New York Times. Addie. Pilbenserin is its chemical name. Sometimes referred to as pink Viagra. And it is meant to treat the roughly 10% of women who suffer from what is diagnosed as hypoactive sexual desire disorder. One wonders how it works. Dr. Lauren Stryker, who is Associate Professor of Clinical Obstetrics and Gynecology at Northwestern University, says she hopes it will trigger an expanded discussion between women and their physicians about their sexual well-being or sexual problems. She said, I think this is going to change the conversation that's taking place in medical offices across the country, kind of the way Viagra did. Sprout Pharmaceuticals has said they will not advertise the pill on either radio or television for 18 months after the drug gets approved, which it has been. Marketing will focus on doctors and not consumers. Sprout Pharmaceuticals will hire 200 sales reps, enough to call on about 30,000 doctors, mainly obstetricians and gynecologists, but also some psychiatrists and primary care physicians. So not a lot of OBGYN and psychiatrists, say, in this area. So it'll be, naturally, it's going to be for people who have access to specialists, women who have access to specialists. But I wasn't being a smart aleck when I mentioned the insurance angle. They haven't decided what the price of Addy will be, but they think it'll be roughly equivalent to a monthly prescription for boner pills. You know, a prescription like the prescription Rush Limbaugh didn't have when he had a prescription for boner pills in some doctor's name that he took with him on an all-boys weekend vacation to the Dominican Republic, notorious, of course, for child prostitution, including little boys. Let's see. Women using Addy are not supposed to drink alcohol because it could increase the risk of fainting. Yeah. Really? She's going to faint if she has it with a drink? I can see potential for abuse here. But this paragraph, proving that my cynicism is not entirely improper, it is not clear if insurance companies will pay for Addy. Although one individual said she expected the product would be covered with a copayment of $30 to $75 a month. Sprout will assist patients with copayments. So, hey! Be happy. I guess. I mean, a rather large plurality of people in this country want to take away the birth control pill, want to take away a woman's right to choose what happens within her reproductive system, but maybe your insurance will pay for you to have a libido enhancer so you can get pregnant more often and have, seven children like Congressman Duffy does. You know, that woman is married to Congressman Duffy, who has seven children. Yeah. Great day for women in America. Great day in the morning. Let's run over and see who's on the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you, Mark. What's happening?
Hey, I wanted to thank you, Bob, for having Congressman Rush Holt on your show. That's very impressive. I didn't know his scientific credentials. What drew my attention to Congressman Holt was his desire to offer the country a paper ballot back after the 2000 election.
He did that. And, he did that. In fact, a couple of years ago when he was running for re-election, people had bumper stickers on their cars in his district that said, "My congressman is a rocket scientist."
And he's from West Virginia, by God.
Born here. Doesn't live here, of course, but born here. Yeah. That's quite a political pedigree he's got.
I see that he also has I just read this, if you don't mind, I was going to read this for just 1 second. The Swarthmore College from 1980 to 88, where he taught physics, public policy, and religion courses. And during that time, he also worked as a congressional science fellow for the U.S. Representative Bob Edgar of Pennsylvania. From 1987 to 89, Holt headed the Nuclear and Scientific Division of the Office of Strategic Forces at the United States State Department. Holt was assistant director of the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory at Princeton University. So I don't know that the little guy with the curly hair from Kentucky who claims to be some kind of eye doctor.
Oh, you mean Rand Paul and that thing on his head?
Yes, Rand Paul. You know,
you have to say "and that thing on his head" because the thing on his head gets very pissed if it doesn't get mentioned, Mark.
You know, Bob, I'm a couple years older than yourself, but it's actually, I don't know that I've gotten any smarter, but it's getting less impressive. I don't know that I've looked into the background of politicians from back in the 50s and 60s, but the people that they're just. It's kind of sad to see the wheels coming off and how uneducated and unbright people are and how easily, you know, I don't remember Congress getting the chance or the U.S. Senate getting the chance to vote on the SALT I, the SALT II strategic agreements. I don't remember them getting the chance to vote on any of our major agreements. It's so hyper political that it's actually jeopardizing our country, and then so many citizens. I wanted to tell you that I call a local all politics is local, but I call a local talk show here, and there's a guy that hosts this show. He's been on there at least 10 years, maybe 15. He's about 6'6", about 300 and some pounds. His father was a cop in New York. He's actually claims to be an artist. I've looked at some of his artwork. It's, you know, whatever. He's kind of like a George Bush Jr. artist, you know. But and he's not a bad musician. But he always intertwines his religious views into his art and to his views and everything. And he's a right winger. And he's actually he's kind of a confusing character. He's kind of like an old washed up hippie that claims to never gotten high. I'm like, dude, you're full of shit. I mean, you know, by the time I was 18, I was in the Marine Corps, and I caught him on the phone last week, Bob, and I said he was talking about this the discussion concerning Iran, and I said, well, his name's Larry Whitler, and it's WOCAAM here in Ocala, Florida, and I said, Larry, don't you have a son? I mean, don't you understand you could be sending him in harm's way? Why do you bring my family into it? I said, Larry, you host a radio show that thousands of people listen to. You're talking about all of our families, including my own, with your views. So if I can't respond to that, your family's not out of touch. Your son could get drafted. And then what they did was I don't call a tremendous amount, but I do call of views that I think that, you know, people on your show, you know, including yourself, would understand. And so what they did was, a couple of years ago, they had an author on, a woman author, who had written a contemporary book about the Bonus Army. And she was on later in the day. They come on at 6 in the morning. They're on off at noon. And I caught them about 10 or 11 in the afternoon, and I said, oh, my God, they've got an author on who will probably be sympathetic to my view. So I talked to her for a minute, and I kind of got the feeling, and I said, ma'am, I said, you know, Larry and Robin, the host of the talk show that you're speaking to, seem very nice and polite, and they claim to be Christians. I said, but you do realize they are warmongers. And I said, they want all war. They want war. And they've recorded my message, Bob. So when I call back the show 10 years later, they take my little snippet and they slow it down and make me sound more retarded than I might normally do, you know. But so it's a polite way of saying don't call the show anymore if you don't believe in Jesus and war. So, you know, it's just...
Yeah, but time out. How can you believe in Jesus and war? You can believe in Jesus. You can believe in war. But I'm having a hard time finding the nexus there. I mean, but that's me, and I don't buy into either one of them. So, I mean, I guess their Jesus carries a M16? Take up thy M16 and follow me?
A Jesus sniper. You know, he tried to bully me. I've met him a couple times in person. I tried to hand him over 10 years ago. I tried to leave it at the station. Stack of papers on the Bush connection to the financing of Adolf Hitler going back to Prescott Bush. I don't know that he ever read it or not, but I'm trying to get him to question things because he does have moments of clarity where he'll agree with certain views. But he tried to bully me on the phone. I said, Larry, you don't intimidate me, bro. You know you don't intimidate me. I might not be as big as you. I said, but you looked in my eyes. You don't scare me. You're not a fighter. I said to him, I said, you know that if anybody can intimidate anybody, it would be me intimidating you, even though I'm not as big as you. I said, your dad intimidated you as a New York City cop. I said, but you don't intimidate nobody. And especially with your views. I said, you know, the kooky religious people in Iran may not agree with the agreement that was settled. I said, but a good portion of the people of Iran are actually pro-Western. And I said, if we don't give peace a chance, he said, do you trust the agreement? He kept saying, do you trust the agreement? I said, do you want war? He said, do you trust the agreement? I said, do you want war? And he was trying to bully me into answering the question. And I said, I'm giving my version of this conversation, which took place a week ago. And I said, you answer my question first. I said, do you want war? And in any case, I've got to move my vehicle. So he broke down and answered my question first. And then he asked me the same question back. Do you trust the agreement? I said, I don't have an option. Of course I trust the agreement. I said, it was negotiated by people that served in war, starting with John Kerry, did detours in Vietnam. I said, I don't have an option. I have to trust the agreement. I said, but do you want war? You know, so I said, why don't you speak up like a man and say that you don't want war, instead of whimper it out so the listeners don't hear it. So it's trying to get him, you know, they make a mistake and leave me on the phone. It's basically this area where I'm at is a bunch of retired Northeasterners and Midwesterners that are political conservatives here, which is why their station, and there's an FM station, have intentionally been put and supported here. And this area looks like a bomb's went off on it economically. It looks, I work all over the country, as you know. This area looks very rough, even today in 2015. And it's a very red state area. We're still fighting the Confederate flag here. This is a decision coming down.
Oh, of course.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the attitudes toward Iran, and you mentioned them being pro-Western. You know, what was it? It was October, maybe September 2013, you know, almost 2 years ago, when Bibi Netanyahu, who really shouldn't be let out without a minder, said that, he said that Iranian people don't wear blue jeans. He said,
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, he said, if Iranians were free, they would wear blue jeans and listen to Western music. So then hundreds, maybe thousands of Iranians in Iran and around the world took to social media, things like Twitter, to show pictures of them actually wearing blue jeans. Because, see, the problem here, whether it's a dangerously insane man like Bibi Netanyahu or any of the the dangerously ignorant people who camp out on the right wing in this country is they've turned Iran into something that it isn't. They've turned Iran into a cartoon. I mean, when Bibi Netanyahu showed up at the United Nations with that Wile E. Coyote bomb,
I know.
You knew everything had changed. I mean, I had an article in my email just yesterday that I thought was actually quite telling, well thought out. Let me just look real quick. I think I can find it. Because you might find it interesting. I hope you're not getting a parking ticket.
No, not quite. No, never.
Yeah,
there it is.
A writer by the name of Trita Parsi, who writes and thinks about issues Iranian, sent me this article yesterday and said, the first reporter from a Jewish pro-Israeli paper visited Iran earlier this month and published an account of his one-week stay in Iran last week in The Forward. Not surprisingly, his account of his travels, as well as numerous interviews with Iranian officials and ordinary Iranians, differed fundamentally from the image of Iran promoted by Bibi Netanyahu. What The Forward discovered was the real Iran, not Netanyahu's caricature of the country. And so then Trita Parsi was invited to write an op-ed for The Forward. It was published yesterday. And he says, the real Iran is very different from Netanyahu's Iran. The Israeli Prime Minister's depictions of Iran have become increasingly comical over the years, from claiming that Iran constitutes an existential threat to Israel, questionable at best, to asserting that Iranians are not allowed to wear jeans, to posting pictures, to tweeting that Iran's ultimate objective is to take over the entire planet. No, he said that. And yet Iran is still the bad guy?
You know, one of the bizarre comments that floated out from the Netanyahu, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Elliot Abrams corners are how they're the main financiers and supporters of all this terrorism in the world. But the last I checked, Bin Laden was killed and captured in Pakistan. Like you mentioned earlier in the show, they are nuclear armed. And the Saudis, weren't 17 of the 19 hijackers Saudis, and the other two were from Yemen, which is a suburb of, you know, and actually, you know, the girl that was shot, Bob, at the protest as the Iranians took it to the streets by the millions during the, you know, right around the Egyptian uprising time frame, and the poor girl who was shot through the head by Iranian snipers who they blamed on the CIA, what a beautiful girl. They showed her on YouTube in her blue jeans, dancing to Western music very respectfully, and her friends were doctors. And, of course, you know, they're not going to be able to save their life right there. They died, you know, she dies in their hands. But, you know, thank God for shows like your own, or Democracy Now, or Free Speech Television, because Americans that are looking for the truth, I heard a couple of people call in to Tom Hartman today saying, you know, that with the attack on MSNBC, how it's going to get harder. And everywhere I've looked, Bob, I'm home in between assignments right now, with one on the horizon. But this big push with Donald Trump, who is dumber than a box of rocks. I mean, the guy is. I don't think he could name another city in the country of Iran. I doubt that he even knows where the capital is. Like someone had mentioned, not trying to change the subject, but just talking about international events, and there's Chuck Todd, they call him, asked him, well, where do you get your military information? And he couldn't give an answer, but it's just so embarrassing to see where we're at. I actually was more impressed with Chuck Todd than I was with Donald Trump. How stupid. I mean, but, you know, he's the one that floated out incessantly about President Obama's birth certificate. This is all a deliberate, pre-orchestrated attack. Hartman's under the impression that it's not kind of softening their pre-prep bombing to make a path for Walker. I don't think that's going to be the case. I don't think Walker is their main squeeze. I think it's going to be Jeb. I don't really give a shit about that side. But the point is, Trump is really going for it. He is a kook, and he's dumb as a box of rocks. And with the seriousness of the Iran, and to have somebody on your show that's so educated and such a good American. And I read about Rush Holt years ago and about his family. I went, oh, my God, because thank God for the Internet, because the Holt family traces back to the origination of the United States. I mean, the Holts go back to the 1600s in this country. Those are the real Americans, the West Virginian Americans, the North Alabamian.
His granddaddy was apparently really something. Supporting Eugene V. Debs was running for president from prison in 1919. Mark.
Correct.
And his, all you got to do is look him up. There's plenty to read. But he was running as a socialist, and that took some courage. And he was the editor of the local newspaper and the town sawbones. Just wow. And that's Rush Holt's granddaddy, Matthew Holt.
Eugene Debs is a relative of Holt?
No. Matthew Holt is Rush's grandfather, and Matthew Holt was a Debs supporter in 1919.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I lost you on the signal. Yeah, I didn't realize. And yeah, of course, it would take more courage for somebody, as part of the Chamber of Commerce to speak out for Eugene Debs. Yes, I was aware of. I didn't know that about the Holts. And there's another connection that goes back deeply into my own life, my own personal history. So I don't know those connections, but it's amazing. I think of Sacco and Vanzetti, and I think of the Warren Commission. I think of John F. Kennedy getting killed and the connections between the Bush family and the Warren Commission, and then Sacco and Vanzetti and the Warren Commission at that time, which were, rich Bostonians and the Harvard connection, the true blue bloods deciding, who was to live and to die if you don't speak the message that we wanted. And then I look at my own life, Bob, watching, Bobby Kennedy after my father, we saw John F. Kennedy. I shook John's hand. I looked at Richard Nixon myself and I said, even though I'm a child, I said, that dude's scary and stupid looking. I said, Kennedy's kind of a handsome dude. And then I met him in person for a second. I shook his hand. He was charismatic. And then he gets killed and I saw what it did to my family. And then I saw Bobby as a hope. And then Bobby gets killed. And then Martin Luther King gets killed. Martin Luther King gets killed, and then Bobby, and then we went for Hubert Humphrey. I mean, and then we were, I've been a union worker. I just thought everything was like my hometown when I left Central Illinois, and I went into the Marine Corps because I wasn't physically mature enough to go into the union. I didn't have the skills, and I thought I could, so I went into construction in the Marine Corps. And because I wanted to come out and go into the trade, which is exactly what I did. And I also learned some gun stuff, and I was really big gun things, and I was also good at swinging a hammer, but I don't live for guns. But just like you'd also mentioned earlier in your show about your own family's lives and generation, if we don't care for our own children's lives, you can't expect a person to care about somebody else's family that's going to be sent into harm's way. And, that's what bothers me. And as a veteran, another thing that Rush Holt said was that most people realize, most veterans, about the tremendous power of the nuclear bombs and how they, most veterans don't agree with us having to necessarily drop the bombs on Japan. And there's that old bullshit thing where there's a million Americans, poised for casualty. But in fact, the Japanese had tried to surrender at least seven times. There's people that say they've tried to surrender more than that, and that we weren't going to let them surrender. You're not getting allowed to surrender, and we're going to use these on you. And, of course, the Battle of Iwo Jima, ties into the distance that both countries, the Japanese and American engineers, figured out. If you're coming to kick our ass with something powerful, whoever controls that runway, Iwo Jima, then you'll be able to drop whatever arsenal you can on us. And so that's why the Japanese put a division into there and worked for years to reinforce all that, which is why the Marines fought so hard. And that's where Bouncing Betty leapfrogged into there, but also a lot of normal airstrikes, which killed way more people than the nuclear bombs, even though the nuclear bombs were, you know, politically and catastrophically more threatening to our future as a people, as human beings. So it's kind of sad to see the propaganda that's been used on our society, and it takes voices like your own, Bob, the people that search for truth, to have peace in their heart. You're a real gift to all of us.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mark, and I thank you very kindly, and you're one of the people who helps us keep all of this going, so you've got a hand in it, and I do appreciate it, and we all do.
Thank you, Bob. Anyway, I thank you, and I thank you for being a person of good nature, and you're a leader in the right way, so
All right, and if you get the chance, if you haven't seen it before, see the Clint Eastwood film Letters from Iwo Jima.
Bob, you know, I did read Bradley's and Brady's book, Brady's from Korea, but I read Bradley's whose father was a corpsman. About the battle. I know that's a spinoff of what the movie's made of, and I did go see the pro-American side, but during this time frame, I had such trepidation to go see the Japanese side because of the deep brainwashing that I suffered from the Marine Corps. I mean, I'm smart enough to know, you know, the Japanese people liked me. I was a good kid there. You know, I showed a lot of respect. I bowed. I put my hands together. I was always polite to the Japanese people. I was not afraid to go out in town, as Marines would say. A lot of Marines would make a lot of racist, you know, trepidatious remarks. It wasn't in my nature. I couldn't fight every Marine that was ignorant, but I tried to lead by example. And I had a Japanese flag in my barracks, you know. But
if you get a chance, if it's not too difficult, if you get a chance, it's worth watching because it was brilliantly done. It absolutely was.
I'll take your word for it. You know, it's just unfortunate that he has any association with it. Maybe he has regrets after talking to an empty chair. But he does have some artistic abilities.
I personally think it's probably the best film he ever made.
Well, that's amazing. I'll take your advice, and at some point when I feel comfortable, I'm just so upset with his ignorance towards the current president, having our first black president. I will check it out, Bob. I won't. I don't mind. I'll get off the air. But I thank you for being the person that you are, because I believe you are a gift, and to have people like you have the one gentleman from West Virginia, and you have Rush Holt, and then the doctor O'Brien that you have on. I mean, you have quality human beings, and they're a real gift to anybody that's paying attention. So, again, I thank you, and I'll get off the air. But thanks a lot, Bob.
All right. Take it easy, Mark. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Bye now. All right, buddy, Mark, calling from I'm not exactly sure where, but it's always good to hear from you. A little bit earlier on in regard to the geniuses over at Outnumbered on Fox, we had a note from Darlene. Darlene said, whoa. What's the success rate of mixed marriages? You know, when a Republican and a Democrat are married, that kind of union probably pops their corks at Fox News. Oh, I know. They're probably still stunned by the continuing, because they are still married, Mary Madeline and James Carville, right? And I myself know some mixed marriages. But you know, the women are probably delivering sandwiches. By the way, a little update to the update. Beth sent us the follow-up story with what she referred to as damage control in it. Marty notes that the arrestee, although they couldn't publish his name in the story I had, the arrestee's name is Moises Treviso. And Marty asks, gee, you think you might be Catholic? Yeah. And the hits just keep rolling on. I was reminded of this story when I saw Darlene's note come in, because Darlene's up in Connecticut. I have to pronounce the other C, the middle C in Connecticut. Now you don't. I'm being smart. You may recall, a couple of months ago or so, we were discussing the multi installment piece in the New York Times about the nail industry in the United States, and what a miserable nightmare hellscape of sorrow and pathetic existence those things are. Sometimes the journalism is at its best. It is, to quote Megyn Kelly, good journalism when it does something more than inform, when it actually prompts some kind of a response. And I can't help thinking that maybe this case is a case of that. The Connecticut Department of Labor has performed random inspections at 25 nail salons in the state. At 23 of the 25 nail salons, the Connecticut Department of Labor found that the salons were violating wage laws and shut them down. This is action by the Department of Labor's Wage and Workplace Standards Division. The vast majority of these nail salons were paying employees in cash without keeping any payroll records. They were allowing them to duck out on Social Security and unemployment. And a lot of them weren't even paying the minimum wage of $9.15 an hour. Neither, of course, were they paying overtime. One of the salons, the women breathing the toxic fumes were paid $40 for a 10-hour day. The salons they shut down owe at least $62,000 in back wages to more than 50 workers. There are $130,000 in civil penalties for under-reporting payroll, violating wage and hour law, and basically thumbing their noses at workers' compensation. And yeah, this is directly as a result of the journalism that the New York Times did. After the New York Times published its article on the hellish existence of workers in New York nail salons, the Connecticut Department of Labor got complaints from people who worked in nail salons in Connecticut and had read the article. Among other things, Governor Andrew Cuomo set up a task force to inspect nail salons and publish new rules. He's asked for legislation to crack down on these labor abuses. He wants the state to have more power to shut nail salons down. And of course, all of this, if you ask a right winger, the free market's going to take care of it, right? I mean, the free market wouldn't long tolerate workers being paid substandard wages, now would they? I mean, the free market cures all ills. No. somehow you think it'd be kind of nice to see when is the last time one of these people who abuses human beings in the name of being a job creator did the perp walk? Ever? Because we just don't send those kind of people to jail. I mean, I'm sure that if at some point in time in the debate on these salons in New York, if the legislature debates it, I'm sure some Republican will stand up and say, "Well, we're killing jobs in New York." Wrong accent, I know. Minimum wage? Minimum daily wage? What? Well, there's a Republican candidate for that. State fair still going on in Iowa. I bet the corn dogs are awesome. Just don't be photographed while you're eating one. Carly Farina showed up. And remember, she's the smart one from the kiddie table debate. And there was a Q&A session, you know, where people holler stuff from the crowd and the politician answers it. Someone asked her about the minimum wage. She said,
"I believe the minimum wage should be a state decision, not a federal decision. It makes no sense to say that the minimum wage in New York City is the same as the minimum wage in Mason City, Iowa."
Never mind the fact that there was a federal, that there's a federal minimum wage, because there's a decision that there's a floor under which workers, through which workers should not fall. I guess with her golden parachute and all, Carly Farina thinks that I don't know, maybe she's a friend of Bill Cole here in West Virginia, who thinks that somebody earning $60,000 a year makes an unfairly high wage. Maybe Carly Farina thinks that somebody making minimum wage makes an unfairly high wage. Here's a fun thing. If the federal government left it up to the state to determine the minimum wage, there would be 5 states in the United States that would have no minimum wage at all. So, there in New York, where there in Connecticut, where salon workers were getting $4 an hour, not the $9.15 Connecticut minimum wage, Carly Farina probably thinks they're making about what they're worth, because the market determines human worth, not mere membership in the class of human beings. The market does that, because the market is sacred. Right. But apparently, if someone is making $9.15 an hour in, oh, I don't know, Mason City, Iowa, they're making way too much money. $7.25 in Mason City, Iowa, is probably way too much. Because if working people can afford to eat when they want to eat, then they won't be desperate enough to do whatever it is that Carly Farina wants done. Yeah. And then there's the New York Times story about Amazon. Read this. Got Jeff Bezos all in a lather. Long story. in the New York Times described by many as scathing. So you use a word like scathing when you're saying true things about job creators. But it sure makes it clear that Amazon is not a very good place to work. The article begins, on Monday mornings, fresh recruits line up for an orientation intended to catapult them into Amazon's singular way of working. They're told to forget the poor habits they learned at previous jobs. When they hit the wall from the unrelenting pace, there's only one solution. Climb the wall! To be the best Amazonians. Oh, really? They must take into account the 14 leadership principles. And they give them out to you on little laminated cards. The people who have perfect scores and can remember all four leadership principles get a certificate that say, I'm peculiar. If you've been off the clock for 5 hours at Amazon, you might still get an email after midnight. And then if you haven't answered quickly enough, you get a text message from a boss saying, why haven't you answered? Nice place, huh? But the public editor of the New York Times has said, the story should have had more balance. In addition, the evidence against Amazon, while powerful, is largely anecdotal, not data-driven, and anecdotes can be used and interpreted in any number of ways. So we've got to have more graphs and more statistics and more percentages. But actual stories by actual human beings who were chewed up and spit out of the maw of that behemoth? Oh, no, it's not balanced enough. The story spooked Jeff Bezos enough that he sent out a letter yesterday to people who work at Amazon. This article doesn't describe the Amazon I know, or the caring Amazonians I work with every day. Well, maybe that's because you're not down there in the pits doing the minimum wage, slaving along, Jeff Bezos. The fact that you don't recognize it doesn't mean it isn't real. So Jeff Bezos, Steve in New York, says, owner of the Washington Post, why do I feel like a marionette or pawn in their game? Why do I feel like nothing more than an observer in their political and economic game? And by the way, Steve said, job creators, that's the real person equivalent of too big to fail. Bastards. Yep, without a doubt. And by the way, as mentioned previously, we try to raise $200 every evening to keep everything rolling along here. For this evening, Tuesday, the 18th day of August, and 2 hours and 36 minutes into the program, we are at zero. Just no. Hey, let's run over to the stress line and see what Jim in Nevada stands up to. What do you know, Jim?
Oh. Just enjoying another slightly warm 110 or something degree day.
Yeah, but it's not that 150% humidity you get down in the Gulf.
Oh yeah, it's that's nice, but it's still, when you're out in that tent so long, you feel it. But, yeah, what you were talking about, these Republicans, Carly, whatever her name is, they just have, they have some cold-hearted SOBs. They just don't care about it. I don't see how people can be. They're psychopaths. They don't. And not only that, it's against, if you really look at it, that's against their own economic and political self-interest eventually. They might get along. Actually, they can run it pretty long. They stand pretty long. I mean, hell, the Reagan Revolution is going on 30-plus years, and they're still selling that crap to people. You know, it's like the Amway scam. If you're in at the top, yeah, Amway's a great way, but if you're at the, you know, if you're one of the newcomers, there's nobody to get it to join Amway.
Yeah, that's why it's a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
It's great. It's great at the top. It sucks at the base.
Yeah.
Because all that stuff sitting on top of you.
Yeah. And it's just, and she's a nasty woman. And there was a picture of her on Twitter or something. And just the skull, the look on her face, just, well.
Well, she's never been known as a particularly genial human being. She's a capitalist brute. I mean, she nearly destroyed Hewlett-Packard before they had to say to her, as Oliver Cromwell said to the Parliament, "You have done enough. In the name of God, go."
Yeah, but the thing that still blows my mind is she either gonna get a nomination, which I doubt, but no matter who she runs against, it'll still be a relatively close race. It might be electoral vote landslide. I mean, Obama had quote unquote a landslide. But whether he can get 60% of the vote. Or if we, when I say 60%, I think almost any halfway decent Democrat should get like 65, almost 70, if you really think about the economic implications of electing a Republican. Because most of the time, they're not on your side if you're working, if you're just like with the ladies who do the nail polish stuff. Well, that's what the market bears, so you get $4 an hour. That's, And then the social cost that's going to inflict on society. It's crazy. I mean, maybe I just look at it too logically or sanely or humanely. But, you must get tired. I mean, well, you saw what they did to the coal workers. I mean, you saw that. You're right down there. I mean, you're right there. You see. And like you said, poor workers get all bumped out with you to attack their industry. Even though the industry's not only killing them, it's not, stealing money from them. And I heard of one of the tensions that broke, right, when, somebody had been stolen out of, or not even, the corporations weren't matching. And then I've heard what some of the companies are going belly up, right?
I think.
It's like that in a lot of industries. I mean, it's like Obama tried to regulate the banking industry, but he didn't have that much time, as much of a, he had 56 and a half days or 66 days where he had both House and the Senate in Democratic control or something. And even then, you got the dinos you got to watch out for. Democratic new norm. Even if, yours, mine, our vintage comes to and Bernie gets elected, unless he comes in with a landslide, like an FDR landslide, and can get some legislation passed through real quick. It's going to be tough for him to do anything. Although if anybody can, maybe he can. But there's a certain segment of the society that, they go through, right? I got mine.
Yeah. America, right?
Yeah, ain't that America, so. Yeah, well, I guess you get tired of it, too. I mean, sometimes it's like, why bother, you know? I don't know what to ask you. If they say the Republicans win, non-existent Scott Spook for dead in 2016, are you going to still consider, are you continue to do your show? Or will that affect it one way or the other?
Yeah, I plan on being here unless something better comes along and I can move to a civilized country. I don't see any percentage in going anywhere else in the country. I mean, granted, Appalachia has its own particular problems, but I'll trade mountaintop removal for getting fracked.
No, that's not what I really meant. I meant more like your radio show. Because, there's something Mike said. He said, basically, if Republicans get it, he's a little bit older than you. He's kind of thrilled with radio. It's just like, he's been doing it for 30 years. And, of course, people change their mind and stuff. And, it seemed like he's just kind of expressing his, just tired, kind of banging your head against the wall. Nobody seems to, he doesn't seem to matter. I mean, until we get elected president for the most time. I mean, we don't get your Senate, we don't get Obama. Obama did actually do some halfway decent things. He did some screwy things. But, I didn't think the Senate's, I didn't think one of his problems was he didn't look the part. He wasn't exactly, quote unquote, tall. And also his policies were too real, Because when I tried to vote for him in L.A., and by the time there was a caucus in Nevada, because I was living in Nevada at that time, and it had already been decided. It was like a 50-50 split between Hillary and Obama, and my vote, I had two choices, vote for a don't vote, vote for Hillary, or vote for Obama. And I think I ended up voting for Hillary, because I didn't really see that much difference. Whereas, I was hopeful for Obama, and I remember when I voted for Obama, in 08, and he won. I said, well, maybe. He's done some halfway decent things. Like I say, he's done some crappy things, too. But I guess with the military industrial complex, you just can't pull out a war situation right away. You gotta de-escalate, let the moneymakers make their money out of it. Then eventually maybe you'll get out. But, that seems to be the way wars go now. Are we technically still in war in Iraq? We have advisors there now, right? Hello?
Yeah. Right
so
here.
We're technically still there and all over the place. And what is that, 12 years, 11 years? Wars was the last 3 or 4 years, World War II. Now it just seems to keep the defense industry going.
That's part of the. See, so much of this, Jim, goes back to the end of the Second World War. And by that I mean you had people coming, you had a massive mobilization of troops who were coming home, and they were coming home from a country that was in a depression when they left, and they had to have jobs. Because there's nothing quite like out-of-work veterans to make life politically miserable for the power elite. And so one way to do that was to keep the country on a perpetual war footing. We just dropped a couple of nuclear devices on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we had just as soon as we wiped out one enemy, two enemies, well, we had a brand spanking new one in the Soviet Union, because we've always got to have a bad guy, because the defense industry always has to have somebody to be making things to blow them up. And by keeping the defense industry sort of clicking right along, that was a way to keep a lot of people employed. You remember the TV show My Three Sons, right?
Right.
Well, didn't the Fred McMurray character work in some sort of plane or bomb plant or something in Southern California? I mean, that was the new normal at the time. I'm not saying that was reality, but a lot of people, and you know, California's population went through the roof because of defense industry plants, among other things. And so that's why by the end of the Eisenhower administration, you've got Dwight Eisenhower, who was a freaking general, for God's sakes, warning the country against the rise of what he originally called the military-industrial congressional complex, and was later, if I understand it correctly, convinced to change to just the military-industrial complex so as not to offend his dear friends who were bought and paid for by the defense industry in the Congress. And thus it has ever been, right? That's our economy. And alongside the perpetual war economy, there was planned obsolescence, and there was and manufacturing of washing machines and refrigerators and TV sets, all of which the new middle class wanted. And again, that trundled along for a while. But it is not sustainable. Just like capitalism ultimately is not sustainable, because it is predicated upon the perpetual growth and perpetual consumption of an infinite growth of finite resources. And then, of course, you have Republicans, starting with Ronald Reagan, a determination was made by the Republican Party that we would spend a lot of time talking about how great America was and how exceptional America is, but the damn people were making too much money. There's those unfairly high wages again.
Yeah, that's the first thing he did was the air traffic controllers.
Well, and one of the very first things Reagan did was to tax the tips of waitresses.
Jesus Christ, yeah.
You know, the quarter that the guy leaves laying by the coffee cup in the diner, yet Ronnie wanted a piece of that.
So, you know, I'm not in these people. You tell them that they're nobody's not working for us. They just bought a Republican line, hook, line, and sinker, and like the previous call was saying, you know, it's one of the reasons I appreciate you, Sean, and you, and Mike, and some other people just pretty good, but I see y'all number one and two, trading places even all the time. But, I mean, I can't think of any times where you've been off or way off. I mean, you usually hit the nail right on the freaking head. So, my hat's off to you, buddy, brother.
Well, thank you, Jim. That's mighty kind of you to say.
I'll let you go. There's you got time for another call or something.
Yep. Stay out of the heat.
I'll try.
And I don't know. If you get a minute, I don't know. Put a bet on the green double zero for us.
I'll send it to the horn. I'll send it to the horn.
All right. Take it easy, Jim.
I'm trying to stay away from it. All right.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Later. Bye now. Our buddy Jim in Nevada Stan. Note coming from Ron and Raleigh earlier. Subject line goes to show you, no matter how horrid these captains of industry are, Carly Farina, people are making too much money in Mason City, Iowa. There's always some lick spittle apologist
willing to come to this, come to their defense. One wonders why the halls of these corporate headquarters aren't littered with bullet-riddled corpses. People are being trained to live under this oppression and take it. And like it. Out of fear. Because what else is there? After all, this is, you know, the greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever. And don't you forget it. Oh, well. And so we find ourselves at the end of Titanic Tuesday. You know, the end of a newscast is where you put the kicker. And the kicker is some sort of little funny story after all the deadly serious stuff that has gone before in the newscast. Well, here's today's kicker. Dateline, Oktaha, Oklahoma, which is in Muskogee County, as in I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. Muskogee County Sheriff has announced that one of the folks who are volunteers, one of the volunteers who is guarding a gun shop in Oktaha, accidentally freedom protected himself today. Sheriff Charles Pearson said the freedom protector dropped his freedom protector, and the freedom protector went off and struck the freedom protector in the arm. Once again, the man was not identified, and there were no further details. This happened at the, or outside, the Save Yourself Survival, and wait, this needs reverb. Save Yourself Survival and Tactical Gear Store. Because this gun store is apparently filled with paranoid, terrified, pants-wetting babies. Because they need armed citizens and veterans to stand guard outside the Save Yourself Survival and Tactical Gear Store. Because the terrified, pants-wetting babies have said they've received death threats from all over... all over the world, because they say because they put up a sign saying they refuse to serve or sell guns to Muslims. Now, bear in mind, they are perfectly happy to sell a firearm to a good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered Christian who will later take that firearm into a school, a movie theater, a church, a women's reproductive care clinic, wherever, and start murdering people. As long as they pass the background check. What background check? Ah, see? Yeah. Sheriff Charles Pearson said, I saw several of those gentlemen out there yesterday. Gentlemen. The way they were holding their weapons with the fingers on the triggers, you can tell a couple of these gentlemen have no idea about weapons safety. It's like the Clampets have come to town. I wish he wouldn't be so hard on the Clampets. I don't recall an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies where Jed shot him, freedom protected himself, or Granny. I think the still blew up a couple of times, but that's just an occupational hazard. Granted, Jethro brained himself with his iron double knot spy hat a couple of times and dropped his wash bucket bulletproof canopy on his head a couple of times, so on the Iraq such as. But I don't think they freedom protected themselves. I mean, granted, Granny did have a double-barreled shotgun. I think she got it from her great-grandpappy Moses or some such. Gentlemen. That's okay. Sleep tight tonight, Oktaha. Because Sheriff Pearson says everybody's entitled to say what they feel, and the other people are entitled to tell them how they feel about their opinion. When that gets out of control, that's where we come in. The only thing that I ask, if they're true patriots, when the threats do come or the undesirables do show up, call us and allow us to handle it.
Well, what in the hell's the fun in that? No, when the undesirables show up,
and we all know what undesirables means, don't we? Yeah.
Well, that's when you holler, Wolverines! And you get busy to protecting freedom.
You know, the moose limbs. Well, I think it's time to close the program down and go and shower with bleach. Thanks for joining into the conversation this evening. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have enjoyed bringing it to you. Hopefully somewhere between now and 6 p.m. tomorrow, we'll find a couple of $100 laying around so that we don't jump in the hole. And, yeah, the fundraising goal on the fundraising project stands at $800. $800 to go. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. First and foremost, you, who support the program in a variety of ways, sometimes even just by sitting and listening or sending the occasional email and letting me know that you're out there. Thank you to all of those who financially support the program. That's the only way it keeps going. Thank you. Thank you very, very kindly. To our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox and Ben Birch. Hope you're enjoying your vacation, Ben. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACAC, ACHEACT.org. And, yes, always. Gina, it's all for you.